Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now, back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
Hello, this is Tim Breedy sitting in for Father Matt Malone, joined by Carrie Weber and also my colleague Father Sam Sawyer. We've been talking about this week at AmericaMagazine.org some of the stories that we've been reporting for you, and one editorial that we actually just published, I guess it was Friday, talking about some of these acts of anti-Semitism that have happened across our country. It seems like there's been an uptick over the last 3 months or so, and we have the editors basically citing Archbishop Charles Chaput of Philadelphia, who has denounced these attacks, endorsing his position and saying this is something, remember that these are our brothers and sisters in faith. And a particularly strong quote here is that any instance of anti-Semitism is a blasphemy against God's chosen people. So not mincing words there.
No. So the editorial is called Catholics Need to Take a Stand Against Anti-Semitism. And you can find that at AmericaMagazine.org, and includes some really, you know, sobering statistics that the Anti-Defamation League in 2015 said that there were over 900 anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. and 10% occurred on college campuses. So, you know, it means there's a new generation of people that are engaging in these kind of hate crimes. And I was reading on Mother Jones this morning that at least 5 more Jewish community centers around the U.S. have received bomb threats as of Tuesday, right? So like in one day. And it's the sixth wave of threats since early January for this year, which is just really, really disheartening on many levels. And I think Archbishop Chaput's point of, you know, really needing to reject these horrible acts is really important, not just as people of faith, but just as people in general.
Yeah. I mean, part of these have been like desecrating cemeteries, which is, of course, awful, but also things like targeting community centers like JCCs, which here in the Northeast is a big thing. And people who, many people who are not Jewish use these centers for daycare, for gyms, and et cetera. So, but these are like community centers that have become a target, and it's really, really shameful.
Yeah. It's very troubling. And I think it reminds us of kind of how quickly these kinds of acts can spread if we don't speak up, right? Like people see these, they get these ideas in their head, they repeat them, there's copycats, there's danger, and it creates this culture of fear that also probably intimidates some people from speaking up. So it's really important for those people who maybe have the support of a community around us to do that as well.
Yeah, and I think particularly, you know, in a community like the Catholic Church that has, tragically, historical experience of how our community's identity can be twisted to support anti-Semitism,
yeah.
You know, it's that much more important to make sure that the line is very bright and we call it out as soon as we see it. You know, and that's not about being alarmist, but it is about saying, you know, as Archbishop Chaput says, this is blasphemous, right? This isn't just, yes, it's intolerant and it's violent and it's wrong, but it's also, this is sinful. This pushes against something that we ought to hold holy. So the Jewish people themselves, but also simply the ability for people to worship, the ability for people to feel safe in their own religious communities. And whenever that is assaulted in public, that's something that I think the church needs to speak out against clearly.
Exactly. And I think that it's not just because of this, but I think there's an element of, you know, there's always been discrimination against people of faith in various ways. And there's discrimination against people who do not have faith. I'm not saying religious people are the only people who have been persecuted, but that I think it's an imperative for people to speak up on behalf of this freedom of religion. And people, just people of faith, to have the freedom to worship without fear. You know, it's really important to be able to live one's life, whoever you are, a person of faith or not, without fear in this country, and in every country if you can. And it's sadly because of war and violence, not the case everywhere. But when we can try to make that difference, we really should.
Right.
And I think on our show today, we have Stephanie Slade, who is talking a little bit about, oh, quite a bit, about the way in which people of faith have been persecuted and have tried to fight for their own religious liberty through the years. And so we welcome her to the show. Stephanie Slade, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the idea behind your article. It's called "The Fight for Religious Liberty is Never Going to End. We Better Get Used to It."
That's
the social media headline. But doesn't it make you want to read it? Now, at americamagazine.org. So, Stephanie, I wonder if you could talk a bit about what the thesis is behind this piece.
Absolutely. So the idea behind this piece was to explore this this thing that we're seeing increasingly, which is that people of faith seem to be becoming more worried, and there's a perception that religious freedom is under attack in this country. And that's basically the idea or the sense or the perception that it's becoming harder to hold and espouse, especially traditionalist views about things like sex and marriage, that people could lose their jobs, they could lose their businesses, that... And so this is maybe a little bit different from the sort of physical threats of physical violence from one private individual against another, but it's the idea that it's almost a little bit scarier in a sense that the state might be coming after us. So I think that there's some evidence that that was one of many things that sort of drove the outcome of the election last year was traditionalist Christians and other people of faith feeling like their ability to espouse the values that they've always held is under attack in a certain way. So I wanted to explore what's happening now. Also, what is the historical record on this question? To what extent are those fears valid and real? Are they being blown out of proportion? Is it like, you know, come on, guys, like don't get crazy. The wolf isn't really at the gate here. Or is it potentially a thing where we should be seriously worried about what might be coming down the line? And so that was how this project began, was as a sort of desire to survey the landscape currently and to look back at the historical record and see what's happened in the past and what can we learn from that.
Yeah, Stephanie, one of the things I took from reading your article was a sort of, a correction on two hands. On the one hand, these fears can't be and shouldn't be just dismissed out of hand as alarmism over religious liberty. But on the other hand, that this is actually not a new phenomenon, right? So the fact that it's felt maybe more sharply by evangelical Christians and by Catholics is a little bit of a new phenomenon, but there are certainly communities within the United States that historically have experienced exactly the same tension for hundreds of years, if not for the entire history of the country.
That's correct. One of the maybe most stark examples of that is the Mormon faith. And the Mormon church in the early years of its existence, the 1800s, they were targeted in very explicitly violent ways. They were sort of physically driven westward, and that's why you find such a Mormon, concentrated Mormon presence in Utah, which wasn't even a state at the time. It was a U.S. territory, and the Mormon people settled there because they were fleeing persecution, literal persecution. But even that wasn't enough for sort of the powers that be in our country, even pushing them out into the western reaches of the U.S. territory. They didn't like that polygamy was being practiced out there. And so they passed a series of laws that didn't just say polygamy is a crime, but it did things like it told people that they had to forfeit their beliefs to not talk about polygamy, to not explain the church's teachings, the Mormon church's teachings on polygamy, in order to have the right to do even basic things like vote or serve on a jury. So this really, this is an example of, again, the state coming in and not just necessarily saying that you can't practice in a certain way, you can't carry out certain religious practice, or it wasn't just a regulation of behaviors, but it really sort of walked up to the line and maybe crossed the line into regulating beliefs, the teachings of the Mormon church. And so that is a thing that I think is really important to understand, because very often in modern debates, you hear people say, especially sort of people on the secular left, they will say, well, you know, you can't discriminate, or you can't refuse to pay for birth control, or whatever the sort of contemporary hot-button controversy might be. But you still have the right to believe whatever you want. You still have the right to do whatever you want when you're in your home, or when you're in your church or your synagogue or whatever. You know, we're not going to tell you that you can't say that gay marriage is wrong. We're just going to tell you that you can't decline to bake a cake for a gay wedding, let's say. But this is an example from history where the government didn't actually stop. They didn't observe that line, or it certainly wasn't as sharp and bold of a line between beliefs and practices as people like to pretend sometimes that there is. They were essentially saying that the church wasn't allowed, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was not even allowed to talk about polygamy, and if they did, they were going to disincorporate the church, seize its assets, and start throwing people in jail. This is a whole new thing, and that's from our, you know, that's not ancient history, that's United States history that happened during a period when we already had a First Amendment to the Constitution that said that the right to exercise, religious free exercise of religion should be protected, and clearly that wasn't enough to protect the Mormon people, and so that to me is a sign that we ought not be We ought not assume that our institutions, that the courts and the legislators, will protect our rights, because especially when we're talking about an issue where the majority isn't on our side, there's quite a lot of evidence that that they will go where sort of the culture is, where the society is moving toward.
But I mean, I think that's a great point, and I certainly learning about the historical circumstances there was illuminating for me. But I imagine that a number of our listeners might be saying right now, you know, like, but isn't it a good thing that they pressured polygamy out of, you know, that we don't have legal provisions for polygamy in Utah, say? Isn't it a good thing that there was actually opposition to polygamy? That's something that certainly the Catholic faith would be on the side of.
Yeah, so, and I definitely want to be clear, and I think I say this explicitly in the piece, that my point is not to say, Catholics, you should be pro-polygamy. Yay, polygamy.
Right.
That's definitely
nor
not
is that America's point.
Just get that on the record.
Yeah.
But the point is actually to say, set back from whether or not you think the practice is good or bad. The whole point of religious liberty is that nobody else gets to tell you whether your religion is good or bad. You get to decide for yourself. And so I say, there's a quote from a book that I put in the piece, that the 19th century Mormons who were trying to resist these laws, they warned other Americans that it was in their self-interest to put down all encroachments on liberty, because the fate of our church now might become the fate of the Methodists next week, the Catholics next month, and the overthrow of all societies next year. So the point is that you set precedents when you pass these laws and the courts uphold these laws that say, oh yeah, yeah, the government, what the government says goes, and it doesn't matter whether that violates your religious faith or not. You set these precedents, and social and legal precedents, that can then be turned against you down the line.
We're talking to Stephanie Slade of Reason Magazine, of her article, which is in the March 20th issue, which is now online. Print title, The Never-Ending Pursuit of Religious Liberty. And we've been talking about some of the complicating, you know, our history in the United States regarding religious liberty is perhaps not as, that there are instances, whether we're talking about the LDS Church or the Catholic Church, and we wanted to bring this up with you, Stephanie, some of these amendments that are actually still on the books, that the Blaine Amendment, the Baby Blaines as they're called, maybe you can explain those to us and what that means for Catholic education.
Yeah, no problem. Basically, the Blaine Amendment, the initial Blaine Amendment was supposed to be written into the federal, you know, the U.S. Constitution, and that didn't, fortunately, that didn't ever pass, but many states enacted their own so-called Baby Blaines, which say that at the state level, in those states, no tax dollars, no government money is allowed to go to religious organizations, which maybe on first blush, some people might say, well, isn't that, you know, we have a separation of church and state, isn't that how it's supposed to be? But what that means in practice is that in these states, a secular private school or private college can apply for government grant money or scholarships for its students, and a Catholic or a Christian or any other religious school or college cannot. They're just banned from receiving scholarship money. Similarly, if you have a neighborhood soup kitchen, it can get grants from the government, from the state government. It can apply for those grants. It's eligible for those grants. But if right next door there's another charitable group that's run by the Catholic Church or another religious affiliated group that's doing even better work, even if it's actually serving more people and doing it more efficiently, if it has better relations in the community, doesn't matter, they're disqualified from even applying for this money. So in a sense, it's actually a form of discrimination against the church and people of faith who are trying to live out their faith in this very specific way, as Jesus told us, to serve, you know, the least of our brothers and sisters around us. But we're sort of being penalized in that there's this money available, this pot of money available that we paid into because it's tax dollars, but we can't access it in the states with Blaine amendments on the books.
And is there a sense that these are just going to sort of stay put, these baby Blaines, these rules, or is there and sort of an active resistance or possibility of changing some of these?
There is a resistance. I mean, there's a lot of people that think that there's something wrong with the situation I just described. But there was an attempt, actually, to remove one of these amendments from the Constitution in a state, I think Oklahoma, but don't quote me on that, last November, and it failed. It didn't pass. So there's also there's this sort of inertia problem where once something gets written into law, it's hard to get rid of it. And so they're there right now, and there's a lot of people that don't want to see them go anywhere. And so there's going to be, I think, continue to be sort of give and take and debate over this issue. But for the moment, it is a problem from a religious freedom perspective.
Now, another issue you bring up in your piece is Catholic health care. And we were talking about this earlier in our show about the way that women religious, this on International Women's Day, built this system in our country and did so much really to help create the foundation of health care, not just for Catholics, but for all Americans. But they've also come under some fire recently from some groups. Maybe you can speak about that and what are the issues at stake?
Yeah, so probably maybe the most high-profile example of these sort of modern religious liberty controversies would be the contraception mandate under Obamacare, which has come, of course, for obvious reasons, to be closely associated with the Little Sisters of the Poor, because it says that any employer, other than a house of worship itself, any employer, including a religiously affiliated nonprofit, must provide free contraception coverage, including the morning after pill. Anything that's approved by the FDA has to be covered in its insurance policy for its employees. And so that means that a group like the Little Sisters of the Poor or a Catholic hospital or an adoption agency or really any nonprofit charitable organization that might have very deep objections to the use of these drugs would be required by law nonetheless to make sure that their employees get them for free. And so this is obviously a problem for a lot of Catholics, and that was the impetus behind the Supreme Court hearing last year in which the Little Sisters and about six other nonprofit groups, the Bishop of Pittsburgh, and even some non-Catholic organizations like evangelical colleges and the like, went to the Supreme Court and they said, hey, hold up now, this is a problem. What happened to our First Amendment rights? How can this this regulation that wasn't even part of the law, it's part of Obamacare, but it was a regulation that was just handed down by the Department of Health and Human Services, how can that possibly be more important? How can that trump our First Amendment rights to not participate in something that we find deeply morally objectionable? Another example would be a push right now. So far, it hasn't gotten anywhere, thank goodness. But there has been a push among some on the sort of far secular left to require Catholic hospitals to make abortions available. And they say basically it should be a requirement of your ability to exist and operate and help people, provide care to people, that you allow there to be abortions on the premises of your hospital. The ACLU filed a lawsuit to that extent last year. Fortunately, it was dismissed, but I think that was sort of the first shot over the bow. I think there's going to be a lot more attempts to make that argument that not having people performing abortions at a Catholic hospital is a form of discrimination, that it's anti-woman. I think you're going to be hearing that a lot going forward.
Well, thank you for that. Yes, these are complex issues. I just want to know, not to get in the weeds too much, but on this contraception mandate, there is an accommodation that has been allowed for some Catholic institutions where they can basically sign this basically waiver and say, I don't want to provide this service, and they don't have to. But there are groups like the Little Sisters of the Poor who don't even want to sign the waiver because they feel like that's participating in the system. Am I getting that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. I know it's very complicated, but just to put that out there.
Well, but I think one of the things that both this issue, you know, the contraception mandate controversy, and also, as Stephanie just pointed out, these, you know, this lawsuit filed trying to say that Catholic hospitals had to provide abortions, or often there are also fights over whether or not a Catholic hospital would have to refer for an abortion, which is kind of in the same range. But all of those point that this is not a question that can simply be resolved by some kind of platonic analysis of what religious liberty means, but you actually have to work out in painstaking detail, how does religious liberty interact with other rights and freedoms that are going to be preserved? And that's really an argument about what our society wants to value. And, you know, like, so the question with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, you know, how does their commitment to polygamy historically interact with, you know, the insistence of our society on marriage between one man and one woman? And yeah, these are complex questions, and they can't be resolved abstractly. They have to get worked out in culture.
And because they can't be resolved only at the sort of these highest levels or in some ivory tower. It has to be resolved by, you know, a very broad conversation with people. I think as Stephanie points out in her article, you know, if she writes, if what counts as religious freedom is eternally in dispute, it matters who shows up to the debate. So it matters if the Little Sisters of the Poor are going to fight this. It matters if we want to talk about it here on the show. It matters that people are discussing it at all, because otherwise I think a lot of this just sort of can happen to people and we can just allow it to happen.
Yeah, so Stephanie, I wonder if we could ask you, you know, I imagine that some people will say, you know, but isn't this just basically a slippery slope argument? You know, you kind of make up this big fear that, you know, at the end of the day, Catholic hospitals will be forced to provide abortions or something, but no one's really going to do that. And so what would you say to somebody who thinks that, you know, that this all sounds like slippery slope and actually it's very far away from happening?
Well, it is a slippery slope, but one of the themes that kept coming up when I was interviewing experts for the story was the fact that what exactly the First Amendment protects, you know, what the First Amendment free religious freedom protections actually mean, is a thing that is in dispute. Again, like you just said, and the line between what's allowed and what's not allowed, what's constitutional and what's not constitutional, is always moving, and it can move remarkably fast at times. I use the example of same-sex marriage in the piece to show that in the span of about 3.5 years, we went from a position where the Democratic president was opposed to gay marriage, legal recognition of same-sex marriage, to Biden coming out for it, Vice President Joe Biden, followed by Obama coming out for it, later Hillary Clinton came out for it. In a span of 3.5 years, then the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act, and then about 2 years after that, all within this 3.5 year span, they upheld gay marriage and basically struck down every gay marriage ban in the entire country. All of that happened remarkably quickly, because if you go back, that was between 2012 and 2015, everything I just named. If you go back just a few years to 2008, at that point, three different states voted in a ban on gay marriage. And that was Florida, California, of all states, and I believe Arizona. The people in those states, they said, you know what, we believe that marriage is one man, one woman, and we want to protect that and make sure that our state keeps it that way in 2008. And by 2015, that was considered high bigotry in this country. So the line between what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, what's legal, what's constitutional, is quite fluid, actually. And so that's why I think it's important that we not just say, well, the courts will never let that happen. Or, you know, a lot of times people will say, well, that could never happen. They'll never force Catholic churches to perform gay weddings, for example. That could never happen. Well, that couldn't happen now, most likely, because a lot of people would be very concerned if somebody tried to make that happen. But who knows? I mean, with the speed at which public opinion and social sentiments can change and evolve, it's very hard to predict what might be sort of the popular opinion in even just a few years from now.
Yeah, and that's something we've written about in our pages. I know Father Matt has written about this in different, you know, whatever you think of these issues, we have to understand and have compassion for the people who you know, this, they may have some difficulty with how fast this has changed, and they may believe, have strong beliefs, and to expect them to turn on a dime and automatically, you know, basically accept the new kind of cultural regime, it's, we have to move a little slower. We have to be able to understand where people are coming from, and that, you know, sometimes society moves fast on these issues, but that doesn't mean that, you know, we should listen to people and where they're coming from who may have some reservations.
And I would add that we ought to always maybe think twice about moving that debate from happening in the public square and in civil society and people, you know, arguing and trying to convince each other, to bringing in the government to lay down the law on the matter. Because that, once you do that, it sort of puts the debate to rest in a way that isn't always healthy.
Yeah, I was going to say, we have to find ways to have dialogue and not just court cases about this.
Yeah.
Right. It has to be, we have to understand these ideas as real things that affect real people, not just that make laws, but that are part of people's daily lives and real beliefs, and see that our neighbor believes these things, or that we, or make people understand that we do. Well, thank you so much, Stephanie Slade, for your really insightful comments today. We really appreciate your time on the show.
You're very welcome.
And for folks who are interested in reading the full article, they can find her piece, "The Fight for Religious Liberty is Never Going to End. We Better Get Used to It," also known in print as something less incendiary.
Yes.
called the Never-Ending
Pursuit of Religious
Liberty. Same article. So you can you can choose which sounds more interesting to you. Either way, the text is very interesting. If you're interested, you can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. We now have a new podcast, which we talked about last week. I don't know if folks are if you're listening to this radio show, you might be also interested in podcasts. It's called Jesuitical, and it involves three of our young, hip, lay editors. We are neither young nor hip anymore, apparently.
But two of us are lay.
And we are lay. You're not. So you're not young, hip, or lay anymore, Sam. But
struck out.
Tragically lay.
Can go find out more about those things at americamagazine.org. You can go and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And if you like what you're hearing here, you can also subscribe to the magazine, and you can give us a call at 1-800-627-9533 to get a subscription to America Magazine. 1-800-627-9533. Thank you very much. And on behalf of Father Sam Sawyer and Tim Reaney and myself, have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.